I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. What does the word stimulus mean to you? To many Americans and some members of Congress, President Barack Obama's $787 billion stimulus was a bailout for banks. But the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act has been transformative for America, as journalist Michael Grunwald writes in his new book, The New New Deal: The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Grunwald joins me to explain how. Also, it's Intersection's five-year anniversary, and we'll look back at another of our favorite interviews, this time with a Kenyan activist fighting against HIV and tuberculosis. That's ahead on Intersection. Just a few weeks into his presidency, Barack Obama signed into law the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, aimed at pulling the United States back from the brink of depression. The $787 billion measure, commonly called the stimulus, has been transformative for the nation, reshaping policy on energy, education, health care, and more. But today, Obama won't even say the word stimulus on the campaign trail. Many Americans and some congressional members see the measure as a giveaway for banks, confusing it with the $700 billion bailout approved before Obama was elected. Mike Grunwald is a journalist for Time magazine based in Miami and writes about the politics and impact of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. In his new book, The New New Deal: The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Mike, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
So you write in your book that Obama's stimulus was 50% bigger than FDR's Depression-era New Deal. The stimulus included the nation's biggest expansion of anti-poverty initiatives since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, the biggest middle tax break since Ronald Reagan, and the biggest infusion of research money effort. So why is the stimulus so misunderstood and in some ways unpopular?
Well, I think there are a few reasons. The most important is that it was a jobs bill that passed at a time when jobs were hemorrhaging. So it was always going to be kind of a tough sell. I always try to remind people that this black guy whose middle name was Hussein and got himself elected president, he probably didn't become a political idiot on January 20th, 2009. And so you got to remember, look, we'd had this incredible financial earthquake, but the economic tsunami hadn't really reached the shore. The GDP was crashing at an 8.9% annual rate, which are really depression numbers, but the unemployment rate was still pretty low. We lost 800,000 jobs in January 2009. Obama came in, passed the stimulus, and we had the biggest improvement in jobs numbers in 30 years. But again, when you improve from absolutely terrifyingly hideous to just bad, it's not something that people are going to get excited about and put on a bumper sticker. That said, you also had Obama really struggling to sell this thing. The Republicans have done an amazing job making it sound like $800 billion worth of levitating trains to Disneyland and mob museums. Democrats have not been very interested in defending it. They mostly complain that it's too small or too many tax cuts or not shovel-ready enough. And the media has really blown the story as badly as they blew the run-up to the war in Iraq. So you kind of had this perfect political storm that has really turned this transformative piece of legislation into political nightmare.
Take me in a little bit more. Do you think part of it has to do with, in terms of media coverage, confusing it because it happened so soon after Obama took office with the stuff that was undertaken by the Bush administration?
Well, I think that was part of it. I interviewed some members of Congress who couldn't tell the difference between the bank bailout for Wall Street and the stimulus for Main Street. But I think it was probably a little broader than that. I mean, the media is not very interested in public policy. There were some very good coverage at the local level of stimulus projects in people's neighborhood that didn't really connect it to the stimulus. People who covered, say, education reform did a great job reporting on Race to the Top. Transportation, they might have written about high-speed rail. Even energy, they wrote about the $90 billion in the stimulus bill for clean energy when we'd been spending just a few billion dollars a year, the real reason that we've doubled renewable energy in this country. But people didn't really attach that to the stimulus. There's a real tendency at the national level to do kind of he said, she said stories. And when you have he said, it's a big government, big spending mess, and she said it's kind of a mess, too. There wasn't a lot of incentive for people who aren't total dorks like me to dig into the details of what was actually going on.
Now, you call it the new New Deal, but the stimulus was different from the original New Deal in that it was a single piece of legislation, as opposed to the New Deal, which was a series of initiatives enacted over several years. So does that have to do with the way people perceive it? If you give it that label, is it? It's not quite got the same aura as FDR's New Deal.
That's true. And I think partly because, look, I think I quoted Larry Summers, one of President Obama's economic advisors, talking in December 2008, saying FDR was lucky. We had 3 years of depression before he took over. Everybody knew it was Hoover's depression, while Obama was really sort of catching a falling spear. That, I think, has sort of cast a pall over this, in that there was really no amount of stimulus that could have turned this thing around instantly. And no matter what, he was going to be out there selling a recovery act during a really weak recovery. That said, I think, you know, the sort of factors where you have Republicans who, before Obama even took office, I document how they really got together these secret meetings that were led by Mitch McConnell and Eric Cantor, where they decided from the beginning that they were going to oppose everything Obama did, and they were not going to fight him on the substance, but they were going to really make this sound like $800 billion worth of turtle tunnels and snowmaking machines in Duluth. And it was a very effective strategy. I talk about how after this initial vote, where Obama has just passed a huge down payment on his agenda, right? This huge substantive victory that really is the kind of purest distillation of what he meant by change. Republicans had this retreat in Virginia where they were celebrating. And John Boehner, who later became Speaker of the House, played a tape of the vote on C-SPAN and got a standing ovation. And Eric Cantor, his deputy, jumped up and said, you know, we're going to have lots more votes just like this one. And Mike Pence, another member of the House Republican leadership, played a clip from Patton, right, where he's saying, we're going to run through the enemy like crap through a goose. And of course, Patton was talking about Hitler, but the Republicans were talking about Obama. And they felt like as long as they stuck together, as long as they kept his agenda controversial, that they would be able to in a couple years. That was their path back to power. And they were right.
Now, Republicans had been planning how they were going to counter President Obama, but the Obama team was preparing for the stimulus in many ways before he even took office.
Well, that's true. And I write about how even while Obama was on the campaign trail, he brought together a group of mostly Clinton people.
And that was kind of a debate, you know, is that really change coming forward, bringing these extra Clinton hands on board?
That's right. And there were a lot of sort of Obama loyalists who said, you know, kind of whatever happened to change we can believe in. They said that, you know, working for Obama was the best way to change the country, and working for Hillary was the best way to get a job for Obama. But these guys, they did come up and they drafted a sort of plan for him that he could adopt when he took office. And in fact, that plan, while it became a lot bigger as the scope of the problem became a lot bigger, it really did lay the groundwork for the Obama stimulus. One thing that was interesting was that these Clinton people, who didn't necessarily share Obama's kind of post-partisan rhetoric, they thought they had lived through the impeachment wars of the 90s. They were kind of skeptical. And in a way, they said, you know, if you've got this big agenda you want to pass, you know, you might want to pass it right away, because that aura of hope and change, it probably isn't going to last very much with the way the Republicans are going to go after you. And that turned out to be pretty good advice.
Now, you write fascinatingly about the dialogue that went on among these advisors and how it resurrected some of the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist. And the Obama people wanted to make sure that they did stimulus differently than the Bush checks that went out that were kind of broadly scattered, as opposed to doing a really targeted type of stimulus infusion. Talk to me a little bit about how this revisiting of John Maynard Keynes helped shape the policies the Obama team took.
Sure. Well, there were sort of two parts to the, it was called the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And there was a real focus on the short-term recovery, and then there was also focus on long-term reinvestment. And so the initial part of the stimulus was just sort of pouring money into the economy. And this is what Keynes recognizes, that when the private sector shuts down, the public sector has to kind of pick up the slack in a way that's not really intuitive, right? You think when families and businesses are tightening tightening the belts. You want government to tighten its belt too. But that's what's happened in Spain and Great Britain, and that's the reason they're back in a double dip of recession. The idea is, and this had really been uncontroversial, every Republican and Democratic candidate in 2008 had a stimulus plan, and Mitt Romney's was the largest plan. The idea is you're going to pour in money through middle-class tax cuts that went to more than 95% of the country, and less than 10% of the country noticed it, through aid to states so that they wouldn't lay off their teachers and cops and slash their Medicaid rolls that denies health care to the poor and the disabled, as well as just aid to victims of the Great Recession through expanded unemployment benefits and expanded food stamps and Pell grants and other assistance. Then you also had the sort of longer term stuff. And the good news, if you could call it that, is that during this kind of financial cataclysm, you know that the recovery is going to be long and slow. So you don't have to pump all that money out in the first 6 months. You've got a little bit of time that you really do want to support the economy. And that's where you saw some of these shovel-ready projects that weren't as shovel-ready as people wanted. But billions of dollars to try to create public works, highways, bridges, subway stations, you know, the sorts of things that would put unemployed laborers to work, as well as green energy projects where you had unprecedented investments in wind, solar, geothermal, and other renewables, the smart grid, cleaner coal, advanced biofuels, electric vehicles, the factories to build all that green stuff in the United States, the really game-changing stuff. Again, like health IT, which is crazy that we have like online dating and online banking. But still, when you go to the doctor, it's all pen and paper, and you have to fill out the same 30 pages of paperwork every time, and your doctor can kill you with this chicken scratch handwriting. There's $27 billion to start to drag our medical system into the digital age. This was all the stuff that people knew wouldn't happen right away.
My guest is Mike Grunwald. He's author of The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. I'm Mark Simpson, and you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. What do you think? Did the Obama stimulus work? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter. You can send an email to intersection at WMFE.org. So let's talk about shovel ready, an interesting term, and certainly one that we heard here in Florida when our high-speed rail network was talked about, because Florida had been looking at high-speed rail for a number of years, decades even. There was a high-speed rail commission that had sat latently for years, but as soon as stimulus came out, local state politicians started talking, hey, this could be it, the moment for high-speed rail to really come to the fore. So this was supposed to be one of the biggest transportation initiatives since the interstate highway system. And, of course, one of the leading proposals was to go between Orlando and Tampa, maybe eventually down to Miami. And Governor Rick Scott rejected federal funds and canceled the project. So talk to me a little bit about what was going on in Florida, but also that Scott wasn't the only governor that was trying to reject these high-speed rail stimulus funds.
Sure. I mean, The initial idea, Obama has said that shovel-ready wasn't as shovel-ready as we thought, which is actually a kind of odd thing for him to say because the administration made every spending deadline. This actually was pretty much exactly as shovel-ready as they thought. There was the money that went out right away, and then there was longer-term projects like high-speed rail being an excellent example. Now, Florida had the shovel-readiest bullet train.
Right. We had the most shovels ready.
Exactly. You had the land. You had the route right down I-4. It was pretty much good to go. You had all these private companies who were essentially willing to pick up the slack and say that, look, we'll cover the cost of any overruns. We'll make sure that this isn't going to cost Florida a dime. But look, I tell the sort of sad story in the book. It's a little bit ugly, but it's not Governor Scott's ideological cup of tea. He really just didn't like the idea to begin with. And there were You saw similar things in Wisconsin, which had had a similarly a really positive high-speed rail project, not a bullet train, but something that would have been part of this Midwestern network that really is happening. You also saw it in Ohio, where, frankly, that project was kind of a dog. So I'm kind of sympathetic to John Kasich, the Republican governor there, who also killed that project. I think in Florida, it really was sort of unfortunate where you had this business community in Tampa, in Orlando, in Miami. Everybody wanted to do this thing. There was a kind of Tea Party element to this where, you know, we don't like trains. That's the sort of liberal way to travel, and we don't like government projects. But it was certainly, you know, that was a lot of jobs. I at the time when Wisconsin and Ohio had already killed their trains, but Rick Scott hadn't yet made up his mind. I talked to a guy in the administration who told me that he thought this was going to be a great issue for Obama in 2012 because they would just show pictures of those guys in Florida building this new fancy high-speed network that was going to whip bullet trains right past traffic on I-4 and create tens of thousands of jobs, and that they'd be able to run those ads in Wisconsin and say, hey, thanks for your money, Wisconsin. But of course, it turned out that Florida went the same direction.
And then Florida's money went to California, which also has had problems with high-speed rail. So what's been the outcome so far? Who's doing it?
Well, the most exciting stuff, I think, is happening in the Midwest, where it's actually you have sort of higher-speed rail, and the Northeast as well.
With the Acela.
Exactly, where you see a lot of money being spent to essentially improve Amtrak service, particularly routes where there really can be competitive with the short flights and the long drives. And the idea is that in the long run, that particularly these short flights are not going to be economically and environmentally sustainable, that we're going to want to reduce congestion in our airports and on our roadways, that this is going to be a more fuel efficient as well as just a more comfortable way to travel. And you want to provide options. And so I think you are starting to see Chicago to St. Louis pretty soon. They're going to cut an hour off those travel times. Up in Maine, you're already seeing where they're extending a northeastern line, and it's created $100 million worth of new private investment around the new station. You are seeing this kind of where the government investment is creating private spinoffs. And it's not a coincidence that right now the fastest growing industry in America is health IT, which was essentially created by the stimulus. The number two fastest growing industry in America is the solar industry, which has increased more than 600% in the United States since the stimulus passed, again, because of these green subsidies. So I think this wasn't like the New Deal where you put millions of Americans on the public payroll and you create these alphabet agencies like the WPA and the CCC. This was in either using public dollars to save public jobs that would have otherwise been destroyed through, you know, the teachers, the firefighters, the cops, or it's sort of sending out money that then creates impact in the private sector, but not directly government jobs. The government, the public sector overall, has actually shrunk during the Obama era. We've lost 600,000 government jobs during this supposed era of socialism.
Well, let's continue talking about Florida and Rick Scott. And different from Rick Scott, before Governor Scott took office, was Charlie Crist, who had a completely different take on the stimulus and was open to it and embraced it, if I can use that word, because we all know about the Fort Myers hug, where Governor Crist gave Obama that hug. And even Crist pointed back to the stimulus in his recent DNC speech, saying that he and Obama were on the same page. So how much of a success failure can you chalk up to the changeover of governors in terms of stimulus impact in Florida when you switch from Crist to Scott?
Well, you know, I think, look, There were some Republican governors like Crist and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Douglas of Vermont, who actually supported the stimulus at a time when when no Republicans in Washington were willing to put themselves on the line for it, with the possible exception of Arlen Specter, who was immediately driven out of the Republican Party. But it was interesting that just about every Republican governor who said, oh, the stimulus is a disaster, we're going to send the money back, none of them actually sent the money back. Instead, they used the money to balance their budgets and then trashed Washington to failing to balance its budget. And so you haven't seen, with the exception of high-speed rail, essentially, the stimulus money has been spent. It's been out there helping the Florida economy and just about every other economy. I have plenty of stimulus projects in my neighborhood where I live in South Beach. I think what it does show is that there is, you can say it's sort of good news and bad news for people who are watching this election, is that the Republican opposition to the stimulus was really entirely cynical. House Republicans actually voted for a $715 billion stimulus that was almost identical to Obama's $787 billion stimulus. Paul Ryan voted for it. It had a little bit less money for green energy. It had a little more Army Corps of Engineers pork, but was otherwise pretty similar. And it was never entirely clear how, you know, the Republican stimulus was good public policy while Obama's stimulus was the death of American free enterprise. It's a reminder that, you know, if Mitt Romney was elected in November, you'd start to see Republicans embrace stimulus again.
What do you think in terms of the U.S. House Transportation Committee Chair John Mica and the stimulus? He was kind of in an interesting position. Here you have the Democratic president coming out wanting to do all these big infrastructure projects, which, you know, Mica surely would be interested in terms of supporting from his transportation perspective. But politically, he's got to walk a fine line being a Republican. He can't be seen to be supporting it too much. So I remember on high-speed rail reporting, it was like he was for it, then he was kind of against it, and then he was sort of for it again and against it again.
You know, John Mica was one of the with many sort of Republicans who are not really, you know, who are not Tea Party Republicans, who are in this very uncomfortable position facing the possibility of Tea Party primaries and owing his leadership position to a Tea Party, you know, a leadership that was being driven by the Tea Party. So, yeah, I had a lot of discussions with Congressman Mica, who's a very personable and fun guy, about high-speed rail and the larger stimulus. One of the things he always used to say is that there ought to be more infrastructure in the Recovery Act. He used to say that there was only 8% of the stimulus went to infrastructure, by which he meant only 8% went through his committee. There was plenty of other, you know, the smart grid is infrastructure, and you can even say health IT is infrastructure. It just wasn't John Mica approved infrastructure. But it was interesting that then when Obama pushed infrastructure bills in September 2010, he had a roads, rails, and runways bill that Republicans opposed, you know, in lockstep. And the same thing happened with his American Jobs Act in 2011, where Republicans who had initially said, oh, the problem with this is that there wasn't enough infrastructure, then when there were just infrastructure bills, they opposed it. They were clearly opposed to, as Senator George Voinovich of Ohio told me, if Obama was for it, we had to be against it.
So where does the stimulus go from here?
Well, it's, you know, most of it has been spent. And some of it, I think, is creating the kind of legacies that can never be overturned. We're not going to start redumbing our grid. You know, it's public policy will determine and utility investment decisions will determine the pace at which our grid continues to get smarter. But we're not going to go back to the old 19th century grid that we had until 2009. The same with health IT. By 2016, 2017, just about everybody should have an electronic medical record, which really should help reduce costs and improve our care. You look at things like the wind industry, which was dead in the water in 2009 when Obama took over. And there were literally wind turbines rusting in the fields. A Spanish company called Abengoa had shut down all its U.S. projects. The stimulus passed. The next day, Abengoa announced that it was investing $6 billion in U.S. wind farms. We've doubled U.S. wind energy. And in fact, even though you see these ads about how we're outsourcing wind turbines to China, we've more than doubled the U.S. manufacturing content of U.S. wind turbines. So we've insourced wind turbines. Those are the kinds of things. Now wind is an example of something that really does depend on public policy, the kind of fight we're having in 2012, where President Obama has talked about extending support for the wind industry, while Mitt Romney has talked about turning it back. That could really determine the way the wind industry goes. And you could see similar things for solar, geothermal, advanced batteries, which was an industry created almost entirely from scratch by the Obama stimulus. You know, whether we're going to have electric vehicles in this country or not, that really could depend on the fate of public policy over the next few years. So some of these legacies, like, you know, keeping 7 million people out of poverty and saving 1.2 million people from homelessness and adding 2 to 4% from GDP, those are short term achievements that can never be taken back. And some of these long term legacies will last forever as well. But some of them are still up in the air.
I've been speaking with Michael Grunwald, author of the new book, The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Fascinating to speak with you, Mike.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Mark.
There's lots more with Mike Grunwald online. Find out what he thinks about the Everglades this election season and more online at WMFE.org/intersection. Up next, a Kenyan activist shares her story fighting HIV and TB in Africa. Intersection is marking its 5-year anniversary, and we're listening back to a selected interview from each of our years on air. In 2008, one of my most interesting conversations was with Kenyan AIDS and tuberculosis activist Lucy Cheshire. She shared her story about finding out that she was HIV positive.
You found out that you had HIV in 1992. You were working in Kenya as a nutritionist. Why did you end up getting tested for HIV? Did you start to show strange symptoms?
No, I wasn't really showing any symptoms in relation to HIV, but it was pretty surprising because my boyfriend asked that we do a test, and it was until after we had actually gone for the HIV test that he actually confirmed to me that the time when he met me, he already knew that he had HIV, but he just didn't want to tell me about it.
Wow, that must have been devastating.
It was really devastating because I remember like for 2 years I was in denial. I hated him. I didn't want to see him. I was bitter. It's like I was going to die because at that point in time, there was no medication for HIV at that point. And even if it was available, it was very, very expensive. That was about $1,000 a month, which is something I was not really able to afford at that point.
Now, you went public with your HIV status in 1997. What was the reaction to that announcement? And you were in the health field, so was there kind of a stigma around coming out with this?
To be very honest with you, what really started me to even going public, one was the stigma that was associated with the disease. So here we are working in a healthcare institution, and people really were talking bad about if you're HIV positive, it means that maybe you're a harlot or you've gone out with a truck driver, all those nasty things. And what I wanted to do is break that stigma for people to know that we are all vulnerable and anybody can get HIV if you're not cautious about it. And it really made a big difference because just to give you an example, in the clinic where I worked as a clinical nutritionist, one of the things that happened is that because of our going public, so we'd go to schools, we'd go to the communities, what we call barazas, talk to people and tell them that it's real, HIV is here with us and we need to protect ourselves from it. We actually saw an increment from having about 10 patients in the clinic to about 50,000 by the time I was leaving my country last month. So it's pretty, we've actually seen the results of talking about it and encouraging more people to be able to start their treatment.
What was the reaction that you got, you know, from friends and colleagues, family members, when you came out with this announcement?
The reaction from my friends was both positive and negative. The positive side of it was that I had friends who encouraged me on, told me that you can always live with HIV. All you need to do is take good care of your health in relation to nutrition. Don't get disturbed psychologically. Be able to see your doctor on a month-to-month basis. And then, of course, we had the friends who never wanted to associate with me. So I cut off links totally with some of my friends because they didn't want to associate with me. And I just want to give you an example of the kind of stigma that I faced. One time, my personal physician actually invited me out for lunch. And while we were having lunch, and then I went back to the office, and also he went back to his office, a colleague calls him and tells him, by the way, do you know that that woman you were sitting with during lunch has HIV?
In the middle of the lunch?
In the middle of the lunch. And that was so awful. Right on the face, it wasn't really nice. But at the end of it all, I was able to overcome it. And the doctor just told her, it's not always good to say something like that when you don't really know your HIV status. And it was really striking because 5 years down the line, the lady actually ended up also being HIV positive, and I was the one who offered her the counseling for her to be able to overcome the tests she had just gone through.
That's got to take a lot of compassion to be able to make an about face like that.
Absolutely.
That's HIV and tuberculosis activist Lucy Cheshire speaking in 2008 on Intersection. She is continuing her work around the world. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson. and thanks for listening.